This is a show we originally aired in February. It was recorded in front of a live studio audience.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media, live from the Jerome L. Green Space. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Brooke?
Yes, Bob.
I just want to begin our very first live broadcast of On the Media to say that the fate of mankind hangs in the balance.
Tonight, we intend to resolve the question, and yes, it is a big one. Will the internet deliver us or destroy us? How is the internet changing you on a personal level? Is it making you better, smarter, less isolated? I think that it does.
And I'll be making my case, the correct case, that we are devolving slightly into sad, evil trolls lurking in the shadows, saying horrible things about one another, stealing content, and shrinking our attention spans like a sweatshirt in a hot dryer.
Right now, I'll argue we're living through an internet utopia. In the next part of the show, Bob will be the utopian.
As if the onset of digital barbarism were really in doubt. Have you ever heard of the site 4chan?
Oh, no.
People do the most reprehensible things because the internet makes them think that other people's feelings are just less real. There's actually a name for that. It's called online disinhibition effect. So that's where Matthias Schwartz came
comes in.
He spent a whole lot of time with 4chan fans. And he witnessed in his reporting some extreme cases of online disinhibition effect.
I wrote about a young man by the name of Mitchell Henderson. He was, I think, 12 or 13. He shot himself in the head with a rifle and then inexplicably became this phenomenon. They made up this rumor that he had killed himself because someone had taken his iPod. People prank called his house. Then they made little images with bullet holes in his head and broken iPods on the floor. Someone posted a dramatic reenactment to YouTube where Mitchell lost his iPod and then went and killed himself. The further and further away it got from the actual suicide, the more of them just start to find it incredibly funny.
They lost sight of the underlying tragedy, a real-life boy taking his own real life.
Bob, I agree. It's horrible. But just because people act like a bunch of monsters on a message board doesn't mean that it's the internet that's dehumanizing us. It just enables us to be more of who we are anytime, anywhere, by enabling us to connect. I give you Exhibit A, J.P. Neufeld. Neufeld stopped what might have been a devastating attack on a school half a world away.
I saw a weirdly titled thread started by a user who I had noticed before, SirTom93. It was titled, "This is it." And I saw the message saying, "Today at 11:30 GMT, I will attack my school with arson and other forms of violence. Those bastards will pay."
He called the cops.
I said, "Hi, I'm a guy from Canada, and I saw a person online saying that they're trying to burn down their school in a few hours. I got right through to the emergency dispatcher. I imagine it was probably his weirdest call that day, but he took it very well. Didn't ask if it was a hoax or not, just took down all the information I could give him. I realized there was a four-hour time difference, so what was 6:40 my time was 10:40 his time, meaning I only had about 50 minutes before he was going to burn down the school."
And in less than about 50 minutes, this Canadian college student was able to call the cops and get handcuffs on this British high schooler before he could do any harm. Complete strangers reach out through the net all the time to help other people. And yeah, sometimes that help is really lazy, like signing an e-petition or something. But sometimes it's not, Bob.
I understand, but look, I have 600-some friends on Facebook. A post here, a status update there, so superficial. And considering it's supposedly the apotheosis of connectivity, it's pretty weirdly disconnected. Sherry Turkle, a researcher at MIT, told me a heartbreaking anecdote.
There was a story of a woman who who posts on Facebook that she's going to commit suicide. And none of her friends did anything. On the one hand, that's a sort of horrible story. You know, what are these friends? Or they're not friends, they're the friended, which is very different. But, you know, on the other hand, when the hordes of journalists descended on these friended and said, you know, what were you doing not responding to her? These people said, you know, we don't know what we are to her. We didn't know what our responsibility was to her. I see people texting at funerals. I see people texting during faculty meetings. People bring their phones and take calls during dinner. We don't take a moment and realize how important it is to be with the people we're with.
I don't buy it.
What do you mean you don't buy it? This is an MIT professor telling us that the internet is making us turn to inward. MIT, Brooke.
MIT, shmemit. Honestly, the fact of the matter is that she and many people are deriving the idea that the internet makes us lonely from a single study. In 2006, they determined that between 1985 and 2004, the number of people that we confide in had been reduced from 3 people to 2. Lee Rainey, who's director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project, told me that they basically just blamed it on the internet.
It was a pretty logical suspect to look at, because the rise of the internet and the rise of mobile phones in people's lives directly coincided with this major social change, the shrinkage of networks and the growth of isolation. But it was a guess. There was no direct evidence.
Okay, so he's saying correlation but no causation.
Exactly. And in 2008, Pew revisited those findings. Lee Rainey gave us a few really delightful little insights into what happens when people use the net. And one of them was that frequent internet users and those who have a blog are more likely to confide in someone who is of a different race. And those who share photos online are more likely to discuss important matters with people of another political party. So the internet is not the culprit in loneliness here.
I get the Pew research and so forth, but all this never-ending superficial engagement doesn't strike everybody as enriching, more like enslaving. We're inundated with interactions, with devices, with media, with factoids. A writer named Nicholas Carr studied this problem and a few years ago made a very big splash with a magazine piece in The Atlantic called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" Carr says that we're losing something, namely our ability to pay deep attention to anything. And Carr thinks this is changing us as people and not for the better.
There are indications, and I think this is part of probably a long-term trend, that we as a society are devaluing contemplative thought, deep reading, solitary thought. I personally think that the loss of this kind of linear, literary, attentive way of thinking is an enormous loss for us as individuals in terms of the loss of the richness of our intellectual lives and even of ourselves, and also a loss for culture.
A loss for culture.
Are you finished?
Oui.
Well, then let me
C'est
just...
fini.
So I'm going to move on.
Q-E-D.
Stop it.
Okay.
You should listen to Gary Small. He's the director of the Memory and Aging Center at UCLA.
We did a study that we affectionately termed Your Brain on Google. And what we did was to look at the brain in real time when it searches online. And we found that older people who had prior internet experience showed a much greater degree of brain activity than those who were naive to the internet search experience.
The web savvy had twice as much brain activity in the areas that govern complex reasoning and decision making. And since these were all older Americans, this isn't generational. So let's assume that Nick Carr is right and the internet is rewiring us, dealing with all these information streams. I also talked to somebody named Catherine Hales. She's an educator. She wrote an important paper called Modes of Cognition. And she says that maybe dealing with all these streams simultaneously is simply adaptive behavior for a new world, that certainly we need the deep attention that Nicholas Carr so venerates. But we also need what she calls hyperattention, this hopping around attention, which the kids are so good at.
They're much more adept at switching information streams very quickly and very flexibly, and those can be assets.
So are you as worried then as Nick Carr is?
No, because I think that it's possible to form bridges between hyperattention and deep attention. I think that you can have both.
So you wouldn't shut down their computers and throw out their games?
Oh, my goodness, no.
Bob, your thoughts?
Okay, well, I think two things. The first thing I think is that you lined up more experts than I did, and that's not fair. But beyond that, I mean, I hope you're not suggesting that teenagers are undergoing some sort of evolutionary adaptation like internet gills or something, you know, that online people somehow have become a different species, because it's a little too soon to be declaring that.
No, I'm just suggesting that this new technology just makes us more of who we already are. If we're lazy, well, then we have all these opportunities to steal and cut and paste. And if we're hedgehogs, we can just burrow deep without end. And if you don't mind, I think I'll let Pew's Lee Rainey make the closing argument.
The notion that there is virtual life and real life and never the twain shall meet is pretty quaint in this day and age, according to the people that we talk to. They blend these worlds so seamlessly that they actually can't report to us in many respects which part of their lives they are living with these virtual digital tools and which parts they are living in their voice communication and their face-to-face communication, because they're all intertwined.
I mean, in the final analysis, we don't really live in the world at all, Bob. We live in our heads. We just think we live in the world.
That scares me. I mean, maybe you live in your head, but I live in the world with mountains and rivers and many faraway lands. And in fact, it is to those very faraway lands that this debate heads next.
That's right. Let's take on the internet and the world in the next segment.
This is On the Media Live.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.